Your job is to tell the truth. That's your job as a journalist. And if you can't do that, you're in the wrong job.
That it wasn't my job, that it isn't our job to be popular.
It was interesting to me how they fit together as a book. I mean, I'm not nearly smart enough to have done that on purpose.
I'm lucky because it's one of my first ever interviews, Ferguson. I told him after an hour I had to go and meet my mates. I recorded the whole thing on a tape-to-tape ghetto blaster, and he's just laughing at me.
Hi all, it is episode 53 of Behind the Lines here on The 42 with me, Gavin Cooney. So this week's guest is football journalist Andy Mitten. Andy is an outstanding voice in Manchester United, and he founded the very successful United We Stand fanzine back when he was still in school over 30 years ago. He's also written 11 books. He writes for a range of publications, including The Sunday Times, The BBC and The Athletic, and is editor-at-large for 442 magazine. So we'll get to the chat with Andy in just a moment, but a quick reminder, you can get in touch with the show, email behindthelines@the42.ie. You can also tweet me, I'm at gcooney93, and if you want to join the conversation with other fans of this show and suggest questions and topics for future guests, you can join the WhatsApp group. The details of how to do that are in the episode description of this podcast. Also, just an unfortunate heads up that I had a bit of a tech mishap with my microphone during this interview, so unfortunately my audio isn't as crisp as it usually is, so advance apologies about that. But hopefully the conversation on Andy's end will more than make up for it. Andy Mitten, thanks so much for doing the show.
It's a pleasure. Nice to join you, and I'm looking forward to this.
Did you start United We Stand as a 15-year-old?
I did, at school in Urmston in Manchester. I spent my first 4 years in Stretford, about a mile behind the Stretford end, and I'm from a big footballing family. Several professionals, many semi-professionals. My dad's from a family of nine, six boys, and I'm just about the only one who didn't receive money to play football. I pay to play, but I am still playing, and I'm 46. So my brothers looked down on me because I wasn't good enough to play for, you know, teams like Altrincham and big semi-professional teams, but I'm still playing.
What was the best football achievement in the family?
Uncle Charlie played for Matt Busby's first great Manchester United side and was one of the first British players to move abroad. He moved to Colombia in 1950 when he was offered a contract equivalent to £100 a week, and he was on £10 a week as a star winger for Manchester United. And he told Matt Busby, and Busby said, did he need a manager as well? And then he moved to Bogota, and it was a year when the Colombian FA had left FIFA, so they were able to attract the best players in the world. Alfredo Di Stefano, Hector Real. And while Charlie was there, he received a visit from a lawyer from Madrid called Santiago Bernabéu. And he said he was building up a team called Real Madrid using public subscriptions and offered him a very handsome contract. But my great auntie was homesick and wanted to go back to Manchester. They did. The family went back. Matt Busby said, Charlie, you're a great player, but you broke your contract. It was at a time when players were serfs. They had no rights at all. And he wouldn't have him back at United. And for a few months, he played Sunday league football in Salford in front of like 300 or 400 people. And then he moved to Fulham for 20,000, which was one of the most expensive players in Britain. He managed Newcastle United. So he was, you know, the biggest name by far, but his brother, my granddad, was a professional footballer. All Charlie's sons were professionals, you know, playing for Plymouth Argyle, Exeter City. My granddad went to Ireland in the early 50s because there was more money there than in the English Championship. And his brother John did as well. And when he died in 2014, I got sent some cuttings from Ballymena or Portadown, and it was like 17-year-old Mancunian hotshot Mitten. So, I mean, they were professionals. And then I grew up from the age of 3 or 4 going to football every single week, watching my dad around the north of England and my uncles and then my brother. I've got several brothers. One of them was just about the first player to sign for FC United, because obviously Manchester United has always been very close to my family. My littlest brother was a young professional at Stockport County, then got offered a contract from Manchester United and went there. But Stockport asked for 70,000 quid for him. And Man United said, "You're not that good." So he was professional, and then he did his cruciate ligaments in his first week as a young professional. And but that finished him at 16 years old.
Jeez. And then that's
really, really heavy, because he was a great little player at 14 and 15.
That is the feeling, that there was this huge, huge potential unfulfilled there.
That loads. Cousin Paul was a wonderful player and was at Manchester United, the class of 95, and his best mates, you know, became Premier League players. And Paul had really bad luck with injuries as well, and then went to Coventry City and then to Southport, and then a familiar tale, unfortunately, of injuries and bad luck. So, but my other brother went to no clubs at all, was not picked up by any academies, smoked, drank, and became a hero at all these non-league clubs around Manchester, where he was called the non-league gypsy. And that wasn't a derogatory term. They basically said if he was offered £10 more, he'd take his caravan to the next club and play for them. And he played for about 15 clubs, and he was slow. A big, hard centre forward, 6'2", skinhead. And fans loved him. He was very skillful. And he got to a good level. I mean, he scored the penalty which got Altrincham into the playoff finals for the conference. You know, you're no fool if you're playing at that level. Mm-hmm. And even when he went to a club in Liverpool, and even the Scousers liked him. So he was earning, you know, a couple of £100 a week for 13 years. And it just shows how football... there are many different paths, because he had a great career, he loved it, and he had a full-time job. He was an electrician, and I used to absolutely love going and watching him in places like Barrow. And some of the best moments I've seen watching football would be watching my brother score, you know, an equaliser against someone like Barrow on a filthy night in Cumbria. And we love it, you know, it is in the family. And Manchester's obviously a huge football city, and I've always been into, you know, I've been writing since I've been 15, and I didn't think that would become my life, but it did. It definitely comes from a place of passion. When I was 8 and 9, watching Dad at places like Hyde United or Northwich Victoria, these were my Maracanãs, these were my San Siros, really, you know. That's where I was going to my first derby games, Earlham Town against Urmston Town, and seeing how much it meant. And I can remember sketching non-league stadiums in school books, age 9 and 10, and, you know, just soaking it all in, and I still do that.
Mm-hmm. And did you, at any point, did it look like you'd have the path of professional football as well, or were you always going to do something else?
No, I played, and... I suppose my claim to fame would be, by 13 or 14, I was playing in a very good team in Stretford. And there's no false modesty here. I was the worst player in a very good team. I was a right back. And in my league, we had 3 standout players. AD Mike, who went to Manchester City. Simon Davis, who went to United and played in the first team and is now, I think he's Vincent Kompany's assistant. And Ryan Wilson, who became Giggs. Now, unfortunately for me, Wilson played on the left and I was a right back. And he just destroyed me every single time. Absolutely. And I'm on about being taken off at half time with the manager saying to me, "You tried your best." And my dad just being floored, because he's a football man. And he's like, "Why didn't you kick the little bastard?" And that just wasn't me. And I've laughed with Ryan about this many times, and he's just like, you know, "Yeah, I'm sorry about that." Because he was just, you know, he just blitzed me. I couldn't get close to him, but we beat him. And I just said, "Well, we beat you. We beat you every time." And our goalkeeper, Richard Bibby, became a professional at Manchester City. we had some cracking players. Now, I'm sort of linking myself in with these players as if, you know, I'm in the team that's good enough. Honestly, I wasn't. I was my brothers, and this is pretty accurate, they would say every team needs a player like you. You're not going to moan. You're going to turn up on time. You're going to offer to wash the kits. You're absolutely shit, but you need players like you. And you know, I wasn't good enough. I was fit. I would run. I could understand the game, but I was weak physically. And that's it.
And how much displacement is going on from you realizing you're not good enough to make it at the level that Ryan Giggs would make it, and then going on to found United We Stand and write about football? If that's not too deep a question to ask, by the way.
No, it's not. I never thought I was going to make it. I was never the best in my class, let alone the area. I didn't get in Trafford, the local area team. You know, I was way short of this standard. And I remember having a major, major argument with basically the entire Manchester United first team in the treble year. And a drink had been taken on everyone's part. And Peter Schmeichel started having a go at me saying, your problem is you've never made it as a player. To which point, one of Ryan Giggs' best friends, who became an agent, interjected and said, whoa, 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 whoa. I played with him at 13. That was never on the cards, Peter. You're well wider the mark there. And then again, that's the truth. But by 13, I was old enough to go to Manchester United games. It was a bus ride away, 2 miles from where I lived. And I was going to all the home games. By 15, I'd started the fanzine. I felt football fans got a raw deal. By 14, I was going to away games and being asked to pay £4 to go and stand on a crap terrace at the City Ground in Nottingham where you couldn't see the pitch, and just thinking, this is just wrong. We're being treated like cattle. And I'd write to football magazines and complain about this. And by 15, with the fanzine starting, I was going to all the United games. By 16, I was going to all the away games. By 17, I was going to all the European away games. So there was no time to play football. I have very few regrets in life, but one of them is probably stopping playing from 14 to 26. Because, you know, I spent my entire youth playing in the street. I did have some skill. And I started again in a proper team at sort of 26. And I probably regret, you know, not playing in my early 20s, but I was travelling everywhere watching United, and I don't regret either. You can't do everything.
Mm. Was that the main motivation in setting up United We Stand then, to give fans a voice that obviously you felt that they had been denied?
It was definitely that, and it was exciting, you know, producing a magazine in school with your mates and very quickly finding out that people would pay actual money for it. And it was terrible. It's absolutely crap, those first issues. And we'd stand outside the ground and we were clueless. But looking back, you'd have the older lads like ticket touts and street grafters. They looked after you on the streets of Manchester. You know, you've got to be streetwise, you've got to be clued up. And they within 2 or 3 years, we started getting some pretty good contributors. And I wouldn't say that I was one of them. I just had a lot of time and passion and drive and energy, and I was a good organiser. And there were a couple of other United fanzines, and Red Issue was the best-selling one by a long way. And I remember about 2.5 years in, you know, all my mates were, we just buy Red Issue, we buy Red Issue, yeah, Red Issue, Red Issue. Just, people didn't buy what we did, but the circulation was going up pretty quickly. And I remember one of our sellers coming up to me outside the ground and saying, we're absolutely hammering it here. We're selling, there's loads being sold. And I said, Red Issue. He went, no, United We Stand, our one. We're selling out. We need more copies. And by the time I was 18, I applied to do a journalism degree at a time when there were only 3 or 4 of those journalism degrees in England. And they were all really good courses with very good reputations. And I got on one probably because, you know, United We Stand helped me get on that. And then I started to consider writing full-time for a living. And then started getting job offers while I was still at university. Got one from Manchester United, basically asking me to leave university and become involved in their official magazine. But I didn't want to do it. I wanted to keep my independence, finish my studies. And I said I'd freelance for them at the time. And that has basically been the template for my entire life since, is freelancing for different people. And it's not conventional, but it's worked for me. And I've been able to carry on doing United Blue Stand, which I love doing. And we're really proud that we're in our 31st year. But I'm able to work and freelance for different people. And I get offered jobs full time, and I politely say no, thank you. I like doing what I do. I like, obviously people might associate me with Man United, but I like going to Belfast to write about the Belfast Derby. I like going to Dublin to do a talk or reading up about Cork City. Or today I've published a piece on Bodo Glimt, a team from the Arctic Circle in Norway. And I've been up there, and it's an incredible story. And it excites me that a town of 50,000 people has produced a team who are going to win the league for the first time. They've got no money, and they're absolutely brilliant. They're all local boys, and they played AC Milan this year in the Europa League and attacked them and lost 3-2. And I just love stuff like that. And football is so much more than the stories we know all the time, the news from Madrid, Barcelona, Liverpool, Manchester United. I know that's what generates the most interest. Most of what I do is about Manchester United. When stations like News Talk call me from Ireland, they're asking me about Manchester United. But that's not to say that I don't enjoy doing other strands of journalism.
Briefly, can you take us inside the cover of the first edition of United We Stand, if you don't mind? What's in there?
I'm going to show you.
Oh, unreal.
It's dreadful. It costs 50 pence, and Mark Hughes is on the cover. Mark Hughes was my hero as a kid. And I once stood on the Stretford End and held up a banner asking him to come home, Sparky, when he'd gone to Barcelona. I mean, it is cringeworthy. It looks like what it was, which was done by 15-year-olds. But 15-year-olds who didn't really have that much talent either, because it's just dreadful. We had a pretty good cartoonist. He was like the best in the class. But I've got to say, it improved pretty quickly to the point that after 2 or 3 years, we're getting a couple of very talented contributors. And I had to put my own ideas up. I had to learn to write. I had to learn how to find my voice. And that takes a long time to do. I was 26 by the time I did my first book. And if I look at the stuff that I was writing, even when I was at university, and compare it to some of the stuff I get sent now from young students, I was miles behind. But I had I had a lot of energy, you know. I put the graft in, really would. Mm. And I had good people above me, not from the local newspaper like most journalism students, but Jim White, who still writes for the fanzine now, he was at The Independent, then The Guardian, then The Telegraph, and he was great with me. You know, 20 years older than me. 17 years older than me. And he'd just say to me, that's a bit lazy. That intro doesn't work. And I'd listen to him because, you know, I idolised him. I loved his writing. And Gavin Hills was Amnesty International's Young Journalist of the Year. He wrote for a magazine called The Face, a wonderful writer. He'd go to places in the world where the BBC wouldn't send correspondence because it was too dangerous. He was in Angola for the Civil War. He'd go to Bosnia during the Balkans Wars, and he would write stuff where I would just go, wow. And I became really good friends with Gavin. So I'd stay at his house in London and he'd stay at mine in Manchester. And the attraction there was probably, I loved him as a journalist and a writer, and he just saw things in a really good way. And to him, I was probably an authentic, credible Mancunian United fan. And he called himself a United fan. I didn't really think he was, if I'm honest. I didn't look at him as a United fan. I thought he was someone who just got into football. But he had this huge picture of Matt Busby in his house. but I'd never seen him at any games. I'm like, who are you? So I suppose he could attach himself to me and my mates, and we were known at the game. And, you know, Gavin was a great influence. And Gavin died at aged 30. He got swept off a rock in Cornwall. He'd taken a week off to go fishing. And that really hit me hard, really did. Mm. Because he'd been to Belize to write about counterinsurgencies going on in the jungle. And he'd been to dangerous places, and then to die. And that really hit me, Gavin's death. And for like 20 years, that was the only person I'd known who'd sort of died in my life, until you get older and people in your family start to die.
Yeah. You mentioned Jim White. Jim is the author of one of your picks today, Andy. I've never heard of this book, if you'll forgive my philistinism. Are You Watching Liverpool? Which is a great title. Can you tell us a little bit about the book and why you picked it?
In the early 90s, there wasn't that much good football journalism, maybe football books. And there were a couple of genres. There was a hooligan genre. So I remember buying a book called Steaming In about England fans fighting everywhere and thinking, wow, this is exciting. And then you look back and think, it wasn't really brilliantly written. But Jim wrote a book which encapsulated what it was like to be a Manchester United fan in the 93-94 season. And Jim was a very good writer and spoke to lots of people, including myself. That's where I really got to know him, because I'd been to Galatasaray away and been locked up and deported, and Jim wasn't there, and he wanted the story, and I told him the story and produced this book, which had been properly edited. It had a good publisher, and he managed to professionally write, rather than fanzine write, what that season was like for Manchester United. So he'd speak to players. So it'd be Paul Ince on one page and me talking about Istanbul on the next page. And I would be one of 40 different voices in there. And he knitted it all together. And he just got inside the psyche of United fans. And it was a great season. I'd grown up not expecting Manchester United to ever win the championship. And now this team, who played around the corner, were winning doubles. And it was a top book. There'd been a few books before that, all played out by Pete Davis, about the 1990 World Cup finals. That was brilliant to a young man. And maybe we come back to that, because I tracked him down 15, 20 years later. But it was so different from like the tabloid newspapers I was delivering on my paper round. And the fanzines had made a difference. So When Saturday Comes had some very good writing in it. And I remember the very first sort of fan diary in book form. It was by a Norwich fan. I think it was called Norfolk and Good. And I saw that in sports pages in Manchester. There was a sports pages in London and one in Manchester. And these shops were, it was heaven for someone like me, because it was full of fanzines from everywhere. I'm sure that I can remember clubs from the League of Ireland, from Republic of Ireland, having fanzines, and every club, you know, big clubs had four or five fanzines, and football literature was starting to come through as well.
Mm.
And over the next decade, there'd be some seriously good football books out there. But the best literature tended to be about boxing. I remember reading a book on Cuban boxing and reading a book by Norman Mailer about Muhammad Ali's fight in the jungle. But there wasn't a huge amount of brilliant football writing.
Mm. And in what ways, Andy, did you think that fanzines influenced football writing in terms of books and football literature, if we want to use the phrase, and in what ways did it improve it? Because it sounds like this book by Jim White was among the first to make use of that fan voice.
You had some proper fans suddenly getting their voices heard. And you can see some of the people who started out in fanzines have become really established, well-known voices, and even in the mainstream media. So there might be people like Barney Roney at The Guardian, who wrote for When Saturday Comes, but also Rob Draper, who writes for The Mail on Sunday, and Rob's a very good journalist. He was writing for QPR fanzines, as was Pete Doherty, the pop star. he was also writing for QPR fanzines. So I think the cream will always rise, and you can just now, if someone sends me something in, I can tell within a paragraph if it's any good. Maybe it's like a football scout looking at a player, and maybe some pieces take a little bit longer to get into, but that's just practice. Fans were pretty ignored, so fans didn't have a voice. There was newspapers and that's it. And I'm talking about before radio stations had phone-ins, before the internet, and fanzines gave fans a voice. And I think that clubs and authorities were scared of fans. Fans were seen as being hooligans. And I thought, I'm not a hooligan. And I was part of a lot of early fan protests in the 90s with Man United fans against ticket price rises. The fanzine United We Stand had started because the British government wanted to introduce ID cards. Fences were still up. Hillsborough happened. And disgraceful things were happening to football fans who didn't really have a voice. And it was only in the 90s that fans started to get more of a voice. I can remember being invited to Dublin in 98 to talk in the debating society at the university there, at Trinity. So you've got the brightish young Irish minds, and it was me and Simon Cooper. Now, Simon Cooper was a brilliant writer, and Simon wrote Football Against the Enemy, which was another book which totally captivated me. So it was a real privilege to be paid, to have our flight paid, to go to Trinity to talk about commercialism in football. And Simon did his bit and I started doing my bit about, and I'd been going for like 40 seconds and someone objected because that's what debating societies do. And I thought, the cheeky little shit, you've invited me over here to talk. Just let me say what I've got to say. But I didn't realize that was the etiquette for people to ask for clarification or object to what I was saying. But anyway, we got put up in Trinity and we had a good time. So Simon, and still I love reading Simon's stuff, more so when it's not even talking about football, and he writes for the Financial Times now. I just like his sort of worldview. But he started out with a sort of fanzine view and has written some of the best books that I've ever read about football.
Obviously, Manchester United has changed beyond almost all recognition since you first launched United We Stand. How has the magazine changed? Obviously, the quality has improved, but in terms of tone, in terms of what you felt important to stress, how has it changed?
You've got to move with the times. And we've got a digital edition now. We've got a podcast now. We've had a website for a long time. We have people who say to me, I'm your biggest fan and I've never bought a United We Stand, which baffles me. I listen to you all the time, they'll say, and why don't you just buy our fanzine? And that's what we're all about. So I have to accept that the media landscape has changed a lot. It's better written. We've got people involved who, you know, if you can get a good editor, it's better than having a bad editor or proofreader or designer. So one of the things which people like best about United We Stand is the front covers. And Bandit, who does them, he's extremely talented. And he does consistently brilliant front covers. And I'm proud that we have people like him involved. For it to survive for so long, you need a huge amount of energy, be it lads selling the mag outside Old Trafford. Not on an opening day when the copies are flying out and everything's great and it's sunny, but midweek, midwinter, when away fans are saying that it's shit and it's raining and it's miserable. And then writers. And we're fortunate because it's Man United, just the law of averages means you're going to have more writers, cartoonists in your fan base than if we were doing an Oxford United fanzine. So it's to try and talent spot and to try and find stuff which you don't find for free online. Because if people are going to pay for United We Stand with hard-earned money, it's got to be slightly different, maybe more niche, maybe more specialist, maybe slightly more esoteric. Maybe we'll cover a trip to a European away game and not actually mention the game. It will just be the fans who've gone there, and our readers like that sort of cultural stuff. And we'll touch on non-football stuff, music, fashion, there'd be a great pride in the city of Manchester. I can remember going to Liverpool and interviewing Scousers in the 90s when that just was never, ever the done thing. And interviewing a writer called Kevin Sampson, who's one of my favourite ever writers, didn't really write much about football. And him saying to me that he basically never met a match-going Man United fan who'd come from Manchester before, and why don't you stay over and I'll introduce you to me mates. I was just like museum exhibit where, look, he goes to games. And I got an incredible piece with him, and we called it Sleeping with the Enemy. I ended up staying over in Liverpool. And because Kevin's bright and got a great way with words, we had a huge feedback to that piece. And 80% of it was like, this is brilliant. We're very similar to Scousers. I hate them, but we're similar to them. And 20% was, this is a disgrace that you're even talking to them. They are the enemy. And we've done that a few times. You know, we interviewed Ed Woodward last year, and I'd say the feedback was pretty similar. Good on you for holding them to account, for being independent, for asking tough questions. And I'd ask the same questions now as I would have asked them. And I pushed to get 90 minutes with him. And 20% are like, why are you even interviewing him? Why are you giving him that platform? And my argument as a journalist is, do you just want me to interview people who are popular, who you like? Do you want everything to be nicey-nicey? Because that's really dangerous for journalism, for democracy. And just because you disagree with something, and I agreed and disagreed with all of Ed Woodward's answers, doesn't mean you shouldn't interview people. And we've done a couple of interviews with him. We did Jose Mourinho. Ollie Gunnar's an interesting one because he actually knows what fanzines are. He would buy our fanzine in the 90s in Sports Pages in Manchester and pay for it. And he'd buy our T-shirts. And I'd known him since the 90s. So he's like really into fan culture. And he sort of gets the importance of the match-going fans, which is a big strand of what a fanzine's about. There's been a huge change. The match-going fans used to be in the majority, and now they're in a massive minority because football's become so popular. So I can remember standing on the Stretford End in the 80s, and it was a cup game against Chelsea, so there was a bigger crowd than normal. And I remember a lady going, squeeze up, let the part-timers come in. They're not in their armchairs today. And I was really offended because she said it towards where I was. I come every week. And armchair fans were looked down upon badly. How can you be a fan if you don't go to games? And that has completely changed now. That is, match-goers are in the minority, especially on social media. Now, I'm not going to expect a Man United fan in Mumbai or in Lagos or in Jakarta to go every week. It just doesn't happen. There are actually United fans in Ireland, in the Republic, in Northern Ireland, in Norway, who've got season tickets, who do make a massive effort to go. And some of Man United's greatest fans are from nowhere near Manchester, the Cockney Reds. When I'm in Manchester, it's 5 minutes from my house. Now, I travel a lot to get to Manchester now because I divide my time between Barcelona and Manchester. But you'd have people from Plymouth going to every game and getting up at daft o'clock, and I've travelled with them in the name of journalism. And that's all been reflected in United We Stand. There's people online, they just don't understand. They just want transfer news. They just want junk, in my mind.
Yeah.
And that sometimes frustrates me as a journalist, that I can go to Belgrade and go undercover with the ultras of Red Star Belgrade and get a great piece. And a lot of people, yeah, whatever, who are we signing next? And thinking, there's got to be more to football than who your team's signing next. I know that's important. I get excited when Man United sign a great player. Of course you do. But there's got to be more to it than this.
I do briefly want to ask, if you don't mind me asking, what did Alex Ferguson think of United We Stand? Because he must have read it.
I wrote to him in 91 and he wrote straight back to me and said, I don't like fanzines, but I've read United We Stand and it's a bit different. And if you want to do an interview, come and introduce yourself on the pre-season tour in Norway. I told him I was going there. I'd asked to do an interview. And I introduced myself to him. First of all, as he came out of a shower with a towel on in a dressing room in Lillestrøm, just north of Oslo. And then I interviewed him in Trondheim. And it was a terrible interview, you know. I'm lucky because it's one of my first ever interviews, Ferguson.
Mm.
Literally like my second or first ever interview, ever. And B, I think, what an idiot. It wasn't really good. I told him after an hour I had to go and meet my mates, you know. And why was I calling time on an interview with Ferguson? Well, I was a kid. I was an idiot. Mm. I also took a mate along because I didn't know you weren't allowed to take a mate. And he was laughing at us. And I've said this before, but I recorded the whole thing on a tape-to-tape ghetto blaster, and he's just laughing at me because he's probably thinking, who's this idiot? And I was an idiot. And I look back at that interview and cringe, because as a journalist, you learn how to be a journalist. You learn how to do follow-up questions. You learn how to do your job properly. And I had ups and downs with him. I mean, he's a great. He's an absolute great. And I had times where I had the hairdryer treatment off him. I remember giving his book a mixed review. Not, it was a good review for his autobiography, but I explained why he'd been critical of certain people and he didn't like that at all. And the next time I'd interviewed him after that, he was a bit frosty with me, but he'd granted me the interview. And then the tape went off and he's like, bang, 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 bang. What do you know about book? And I thought, I'm not scared of you. I'm not scared of you at all. And I do know about books because I write books. And just as I'm about to start answering back, anyway, son, it's great to see you. Do you want a picture? So he's done me. He's like put me on the ropes verbally, bang, 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 bang. And just as I'm about to swing back verbally, anyway, son, it's great to see you. And that's really clever what he did. Because he's made his point. He gave me a good interview. And I don't think he liked the fanzines. I don't think he liked the fact that we objected to the Glazer takeover of Manchester United. And, well, he didn't. And we'll just agree to disagree on that. I'd rather remember him for some of the greatest moments ever. And thanks to that man, I've travelled the world. And it's been a major part of my job, because when we started the fanzine, average crowds were 38,000. United didn't win anything. Manchester United paid AC Milan to come to Old Trafford and play a friendly. A decade later, United were knocking the best teams in the world out of European competition and weren't having to pay an appearance fee for the privilege. So with Fergie, I mean, with other managers, I've had really strong relationships with some and with players. You know, a couple of them you'd call friends. Not that you should get into it like that as a journalist, but I've interviewed over 1,000 footballers. Invariably, I'm going to get on better with some than others. And you know, when you do columns with guys and you're speaking to them twice a week, you you get to know them really well.
Mm.
I've seen Fergie since.
Did you ever figure Ferguson out?
There's so many contrasts to Ferguson, because through my family, I've got another very strong link to Ferguson. And my father remarried, and his wife's father was Ferguson's kitman. So his closest confidant. Literally, Fergie would come to my dad's house and pick him up after the kitman Norman Davis had died in 2008, and would be in my dad's front room, not knowing the connection to me. And my little brother would be receiving, and still receives, you know, Christmas presents off Alex and Kathy. Or I would be invited to the 70th birthday of Norman Davis, God rest his soul, He died in 2008. And I'd be sat there and, you know, Kathy Ferguson would come and sit next to me. And I've no idea what I did for a job. And I switched off being a journalist. I found her more interesting telling me about the shipyards on the Clyde in the 50s. You know, really interesting lady. And, you know, with Fergie, you get so close to the sun, sometimes you get burned by it.
Mm.
And I wasn't doing the journalism that I'm doing now when he was in charge. I wasn't at all the press conferences. Maybe I didn't want to be. I didn't want to lose my love for him. Maybe I didn't want to see that side of him too much. Maybe I still wanted to sing his name and celebrate when he decided to stay at United. I've heard enough amazing things about him to know that there's a huge amount of goodness there. And I know, you know, just incredible acts of kindness that he's done over the years, which mark him as a good human. And we disagree on other stuff. And that's fine. You're allowed to disagree with people.
Mm.
And but you know, he was autocratic. I didn't agree with him banning some of the journalists just for writing the truth. I don't think he'd get away with that now. But he was of an age and he did that to his style. But look, you know, this is a man who took a team to Turin in 99. And I'm sat there at half time thinking, I've never felt like this in my life. And you're not playing, you're only a fan, you're detached from it. You know, we might say we, but it's not you. You're not contributing to it. Maybe as a collective you are, but it's reflected glory. And I was so proud in that main stand in Turin that team from my city were absolutely battering the best team in the world. I've never felt like that, not even in the final. It was, and these middle-class Italians around me were just looking and saying, I didn't understand Italian, but I could understand them perfectly. And I just got a feeling of, we're being battered by brilliance here. And it was amazing. And at the end of the game, they were very nice with me. And then that gave me a misplaced sense of confidence because I ran around the back of the away end to meet my mates in the away end and got battered by some Juventus hooligans who saw that, oh, probably they didn't look like I was from Turin. So yeah, I'd asked a steward for directions in English. Someone heard me, bang, just booted me.
And, Jesus.
So you become pretty streetwise, you know?
Yeah. And did you end up in hospital? Like, how serious was this?
I got a proper boot to the thigh. And I messed up then because I said Torino, as if to say I'm from Torino, but Torino are Juventus' greatest rivals.
Yeah.
And the steward said to me in Italian, which I understood perfectly, as if, I don't care what you're saying, get out of here now. And I ran back to the car and I waited for my mates who came out of the away end where 4,500 United fans were. An hour later, got back to the car. We were all so high because United were going to the European Cup final. And then we drove back to our cheap hotel in Genoa. And I opened the door in Genoa, I stepped out the car, and my leg just gave way because the adrenaline was wearing off then. And I looked at my leg and I had a massive, massive bruise, but it didn't go beyond a bruise.
Mm.
I had a few other whacks, Leeds United away, and I think it's the law of averages. And you learn, you know, going to the turnstiles at Leeds United away, age 17, and deciding to sing Manchester. You know, I was met with a right hook.
And did you, Annie, when you were a journalist, because obviously you were writing for a number of outlets, but running United We Stand as well, were you trying to detach yourself from things to the level that most journalists would say you have to be detached, or did you feel like I can be a little bit more partisan here?
In the early years, it was United We Stand, it was magazine journalism, and I've never hid who I support, and I don't think that I should do. I know there are journalists who would totally disagree with me here, but I think if you've been a proper football fan, you shouldn't be embarrassed about that. And I would have a huge amount of respect for anyone who is a proper football fan, who supports their team through thick and thin. And it doesn't matter who they support. And some of my best mates are Manchester City fans who I respect as football fans because they followed the team through thick and thin. I can remember them going to Gillingham away when Manchester United were going to Juventus away. And I met lads who support Liverpool, who are brilliant Liverpool fans, and I just respect them. So I honestly feel when I write about other clubs, I can do it objectively. And when I go to Liverpool, I might do that twice a year. They let me in. The club let me in. And I don't mean just let me in as in giving me a pass. I mean, they trust me. They're hardcore fans. I would know people who would basically be able, they would say, yeah, he's a mank, whatever. But he knows what he's doing. And I think that that would come out in the work that I do. Some of my favourite work has not been about Manchester United. And some of the journalists I've mentioned, I've been proper football fans. I'd rather that than someone who, you know, fell into it or preferred a different sport, you know, preferred rugby, but couldn't find a job in there in writing about rugby or motor racing because football's a much bigger market. So some people will definitely associate me with Man United, but I know the outlets who I'm writing for. If I need to write a straight match report on Manchester City against Newcastle United, I can do it. I can do it. I can just switch off. I'm not going to snidely have a dig. And sometimes people expect you to just reinforce their prejudice, and that's really dangerous for journalism as well. So if I put a tweet out now just saying, you know, Marcus Rashford is great. Yeah, great, great. But if you offered a counter view, a lot of my followers don't want that. So I actually stuck up for Manchester City a year or two ago when they were going to Wembley for the fourth time. And they didn't sell all the tickets. And Man United fans were going, yeah, you can't sell all your tickets, empty seats. And I was thinking, my brother-in-law is a City fan. And that obviously guts me because his kids are City, a little City fans. And my sister's a disgrace for allowing that to happen because they've now got season tickets. And he said, I can't afford to go to Wembley for the fourth or fifth time this year. And he's a proper City fan. And I respect him as being a proper football fan. And I was seeing Man United fans who've never been to a game having a go at people like him and thought, nah. So I stuck up for City fans. And that got a response from some Man United fans like, what's he doing? You know, he's supposed to be slaughtering them. And from Manchester City fans were, which would be something like, I've always hated that rag bastard, but he's got a point here. So that is tribalism. And you know, you get quite a lot of heat when you write stuff like that. But you can't live a lie. I was sent to the 2019 European Cup final between Liverpool and Spurs. Of course I wanted Liverpool to lose, but I wrote a piece on how brilliant Alisson the goalkeeper was and knew enough about him because my wife's from East City and grew up a few hundred yards from him to offer insight, which is what a journalist should always do. So, and I met a couple of my Scouse mates before that game and they're just laughing at me and I'm thinking, you know, why am I in Madrid watching Liverpool in the European Cup final? Well, the truth is I was getting paid to be there and it's my job and that's how I pay my mortgage. And that's just how it is. If you don't like it, you don't have to read my stuff.
We'll move on briefly, Andy, to another of your picks. Ronald Reng, most of us will know him from his award-winning book on the tragic goalkeeper Robert Enke, but you've also mentioned another of his books called The Keeper of Dreams, which, again, I hadn't heard of. So you might tell us a little bit about him and about Ronald generally.
Ronald, or Ronnie as I know him, is a fantastic, I mean, one of the best in the world. He's that good, writers. And since 2001, I've been in most of my time in Barcelona. I'm now married, my children are there, my wife's there, my kids speak Catalan. And Ronnie was also living in Barcelona. And we started playing in the same football team. And he gave me a copy of his book. Ronnie was a goalkeeper and he'd written a book about a goalkeeper who'd moved from Germany to Barnsley. And it was amazing. And it is amazing. And buy it now because it's still good all these years later. I, by a quirk of bizarre circumstances, had gone to Barnsley as the third choice keeper because they needed a third keeper because they'd just got into the Premier League, which Barnsley had never done before. And, you know, he was on 800 quid a week or something. And it's 20 years since I've read it, but he moves to Barnsley, which isn't New York, you know, it's not the most cosmopolitan place. And he's a bright German guy. And his eyes are like, this is the things he sees with, you know, how much the players are drinking, the groupies. And he doesn't expect to play at all. And then 3 months in, because of injuries, suddenly he's keeping goal for Barnsley away at Liverpool in the Premier League. And it's just brilliant. I love it that sport can offer this. And Ronnie captured that small town mentality, that happiness. I think they beat Man United in the Cup that year. And it was just a wonderful book. And Ronnie got the trust of the players. And I know a few of the players were annoyed afterwards because he wrote pretty much everything, which meant, you know, taking a girl into the toilets in Barnsley's number 4 nightclub. And I think as a journalist, you've got to know where your boundaries are at times. And Ronnie could walk away from Barnsley, never needing to go there again. I can't really do that with Manchester. And it was a great book. And I then started a team up called Manchester in Barcelona in 2006. And I invited Ronnie to be my goalkeeper. And he will still say to this day, it's the best team he's ever played in. And we had a cracking team. Mm. And because I was managed, I started it so that I could get a game basically and pick myself right back. And again, I was the worst player in a really good team with several former pros in there. And Ronnie, we called him the Kaiser. I basically had all of Barcelona calling this really intellectual German writer the Kaiser. And I did have to say, this isn't offensive, is it, Ronnie, calling you the Kaiser? No, no. It was a term of endearment before the First World War. And Ronnie kept telling me to go and interview someone he knew very well called Robert Enker, who'd been a goalkeeper at Barcelona, Benfica, and was now goalkeeper in Hanover. And I thought, sounds interesting. I trust Ronnie. Next time I'm in Germany, I'll go and see Robert Enker. In 2008-09, Manchester United played Wolfsburg, which is very close to Hanover. Ronnie rang Robert, who agreed to meet me. I was going to do him for 442 magazine. And Ronnie, this is the opening page of the book on Robert Enker, which is an international bestseller. And Ronnie starts the intro as saying that he rang Robert just to check and confirm the dates with the English journalist. And that's me. And on that afternoon, Robert took his life. And my friends with a very dark humor would say the prospect of meeting you meant Robert Enker took his life. But it was incredibly sad what happened. That you've got this international class goalkeeper, obviously he took his own life, he had a young family, and Ronnie Reng knew the family and he wrote this book, and I couldn't finish the book, if I'm honest. I couldn't finish it. It's too heavy for me. I don't know why, I just couldn't finish it. And I know that's the award winning book, and I don't know why. Football's my life every single day, and at times I just need to get away from it, and maybe that was getting too deep. And Ronnie was telling me, as he was writing the book, for example, he'd say, I've just been to see Victor Valdez at Barca, and Valdez was quite dismissive. Okay, I've got 10 minutes, and okay, what do you want to talk about? Okay, yeah, I remember Robert Enker, he was my understudy. And Ronnie's saying to him, I need more than 10 minutes with you. And Valdez just switching, and 3 hours later, pouring his heart out to me. And he was telling me all this as he was writing the book, because he was my goalkeeper and he needed to keep in my good books, otherwise I would have dropped him. Mm-hmm. And, you know, privately, I didn't tell him, but you probably gathered, I had a huge amount of respect for him. And we talk about journalism. And I remember getting a job offer from one of the agencies in 05-06, and, you know, traveling around Spain, writing about Spanish football, being paid to do it. And Ronnie Reng just said, nah, that's not for you. That's not for you. You don't do that. you do something slightly different. Don't think the grass is always greener. And he was right, actually.
Mm.
And Ronnie, you know, we're very, very different. He probably wouldn't do this podcast with you. He doesn't do any media. He does a tiny bit when his books are out. And, you know, he's just a very funny guy and a hugely talented writer. And he'd just tell me stories about his dad in Frankfurt having a mobile phone, but only switched it on when he wanted to make a call. And I love the idiosyncrasies of stuff like that. But in life, you go through life and you meet people who are fascinating, and Ronnie Reng would be one of them. And his books are, when I see the best ever football books, his book on Robert Enker is frequently number one.
Mm.
Great.
And it does seem to have, that book seemed to have a kind of a transformative effect on how people view footballers. I hope, at least, that people were a lot more sympathetic and empathetic towards footballers after that release, because they just make so much money. It's hard to remove that filter between people watching the footballers play and the footballers themselves, but maybe that humanized them to a degree that they hadn't been hitherto.
Yeah. Enke was a bright lad. He spoke different languages. He's playing for Benfica and Barcelona, and yet he's really unhappy. When the book came out, people knew that I knew him. A few sports writers and a few footballers came to me and asked me to either put me in touch with Ronnie Reng or pass on their gratitude, because they'd had serious issues with mental illness and they'd got a lot from reading the book. Ronnie didn't really have much desire to meet anyone, if I'm honest. I think that's how he just works in his own bubble, but he appreciated the feedback that I gave him.
Mm. Hey, Andy, we're nearly home. Well, we just have time for one listener question maybe, and then our two stock questions we ask everyone toward the end of the show. I think a couple of people were interested in simply what's the best United team that you've seen, because the obvious answer would probably be the treble team, but like my own opinion is that 07 to 09 team with the Ronaldo. Rooney, Berbatov, Tevez team. I think that they might beat the treble team.
Yeah, you're asking me to decide, you know, which supermodel would you like to take home tonight? You know, these teams are so far in excess of what I was watching when I was a kid. The team that won the league in 93, the 94 double winners, were amazing and would have done better in Europe if it wasn't for the free foreigner rules. The treble winners won the treble. Maybe I have more affinity because I'm the same age as a lot of them lads. I'm from the same city. I knew them as kids. I still know them. I'm not the friends, but I know them, you know, they know me. And you know, Manchester lads who'd come through and then the treble, you know, the treble was the treble, but would the 08 team have beaten them? Maybe they would have done, you know, maybe Vidic and Ferdinand, well, they probably were better than the central defensive partnership of the treble winning team. So they would be the three, if I'm honest. 94, 99, 08, if you're going to ask me to separate one of them, going to decline that answer. I can't do it. It's so subjective. You know, it's like asking me who's the best out of Roy Keane and Brian Robson. It's impossible to answer.
Okay, two final questions, Andy. Who is the most interesting person you've met with work? If that's not several. Too difficult a question.
Several. Roy Keane would be up there. Really would be up there.
Do you find Roy interesting? Do you still find him interesting, actually? Because this actually came up on last week's podcast when we see him as a pundit now. Like, where the whole country here is obviously fascinated by Keane, but the more I see of him on TV at the moment, the less interested I'm becoming in him.
Mm, I could see that. I knew him when he played at United. Felt that you could get a different Roy on the Monday to meeting Roy on a Tuesday. He was always very good with me as a journalist. He gave me some incredible interviews. We have major bust-ups, you know, disagreements over the merits of Tony Cascarino's book. I should put Cascarino's book in there. I thought that was incredible in its honesty. Really did. Great, great book. And I asked Roy that. So I asked him, you know, what you're asking me. And this was in Philadelphia in 05. And I don't think Roy was Cascarino's biggest fan at the time. And I'm like, yeah, but that's not the point. Well, have you read his book? I went to see Maradona last year in Sinaloa in Mexico. I reckon if I would have got there on a Tuesday, I would have got a very different interview. Well, because I didn't even have an interview set up, had he arrived on the Monday. But I did arrive on the Monday. I met his wife, and he was magnificent. And he started telling me how he wanted to take over at Old Trafford. And I thought, these quotes are going around the world, and that's exactly what they did. Slightly frustrating when your mates send you links saying, have you seen this about Maradona in the Mirror, about him wanting to manage Man United? I'm thinking, it wasn't in the Mirror. Mm. That took me 6 days to go to Mexico to get them quotes. And I got them for 442 magazine, who paid my airfare. And that type of journalism costs a lot of money. But now you get the clickbait operations just stealing your best stuff. And that doesn't always fill me with glee. Those quotes are just gold.
Yeah. I just, with my Irish hat on, I do have to circle back and ask you, like, did Roy Keane have much of a literary critique of Tony Cascarino's book, or was it more personal?
Roy was never, ever going to read Tony's book. Roy's two autobiographies are absolutely fascinating. And as a journalist, I will never forget the first page in his first autobiography that was done with Roddy. Was it done with Roddy Doyle? Or was it Eamon, done with Eamon Dunphy?
Eamon Dunphy was the first one, yeah.
And it was brilliant. So he's in Saipan, everything's gone on, and he's at the airport, and the whole world is honing in on Roy Keane. And if I remember rightly, a British businessman saw him, went up to him and just said, can I buy you a cup of tea? And that is all he needed at that time in his life. He didn't want to talk about football. He didn't want to be recognised. He knew there was a shitstorm coming. And I just thought, journalistically, that was used so well as an introduction to a book, because it starts in the eye of the storm. And I might have got some details a little bit wrong, because I can remember reading it voraciously in September 2002, I think, when it came out, and I've not touched it since. But maybe because I've met Roy a few times, and I just thought, this guy's just penetrated him straight away with the simple offer of a cup of tea.
Mm.
And I love that.
I know Keane wasn't going to read Tony Cascarino's book. I can't imagine Roy Keane reading any footballer's autobiography book, I have to say.
No, but he's a complex, brilliant man. I mean, footballer, one of the best ever. Journalistically, he's given me some amazing interviews. At other times, he's rejected me for interviews when I'm not used to rejection. Really, you know, I'm getting 15 letters back from his teammates and he's the only rejection. And at other times, I'm hearing stories of him going to youth clubs in South Manchester, doing a dinner, refusing a fee, and basically saying, I'm here as long as you want me. And there's plenty of stories like that. I know lads, Simon Corain was a Man United fan who went everywhere and died of stomach cancer in his early 30s. And Roy turned up in the hospital a few nights before he died. And there's a lot of that with Roy. Mm. And that was never made public. And this is 15, 20 years ago. And some of the stuff does get made public. So when I went to Cork for the Liam Miller game, you know, Roy had pulled all that together. So there's a great man there, and I can see why in Cork people love him. And if I get rejected from an interview with him, they were like that. No, I don't like it, because it's so interesting. But that's life, you know. You might be a single lad and get rejected by a girl. That's just life. But he, when he was in Cork, there was almost no journalist who travelled over from the UK. But the press conference was absolutely packed with Irish journalists, because it was a big deal there. 45,000 people were there. And I thought, I'm gonna ask him the first question. There's 100 Irish journalists in there. I'm going to get in there straight up, straight in front of him, bang, knowing that you don't know whether he's going to rip your head off or be the most interesting person. I just quite like that idea of But of course, because of the occasion, he was brilliant and he was self-depreciative. And he's like, no, I'm not good enough to get in this team. And there's a lot of that about him. Remember Jesper Blomqvist being upset because Roy had refused to speak to him for 7 weeks after being yellow carded in Turin. And Jesper's like, because I know Jesper well. And Jesper's like, it wasn't even a bad pass, Andy. And it wasn't. It was just Roy going off on one. And I told Roy that story when I met him at Manchester Airport a few years ago. And he was gutted. He's like, hell of a player, Jesper. Hell of a player. And it was lovely to hear. Because he was the best player in that team.
Yeah, because he was... I didn't know, realize he had such a high opinion of Jesper Blomqvist until he was on Sky a few months ago picking a Liverpool United 11 with Jamie Carragher. And Carragher was trying to put in like Sadio Mane or something from Liverpool. And Keane was like, no, Jesper Blomqvist goes in for me. And so he effectively picked an all-United 11. And Carragher, having started out thinking, I might get the majority here, was happy with Virgil van Dijk. You know, that was the end. Listen, Andy, we're gone way over time. I'll ask you quickly, because we ask everyone, the most interesting plagues that work has brought you.
I know we're over time. I've got to say that Jamie Carragher's probably bought more United where he stands than any other professional footballer.
And I
think that is a big plus for Jamie Carragher in understanding football fan culture. Most interesting places, and this one involves Ireland, but it wasn't in Ireland, although Belfast for the derby was very interesting. Tehran, 2014, first, I think, British journalist to get a visa to go there because Britain doesn't have the best diplomatic relations, if I put it politely, with every country in the world. So I was sent to the embassy in Dublin to pick up a visa, where I felt like they were grilling me to find out whether Carlos Queiroz, the Iranian national team manager, was going to stay and sign a new contract. So I'm in a very posh part of Dublin, Blackrock, maybe.
Yeah.
And they were grilling me and they said, you know, this visa is going to be 100. And then it went up to 200 to 300. And when it got to 400 euros, my editor at 442 said, if it goes above 500 euros, you're not going to Iran. And then I received a call from a head of security in Tehran having a go at me because the way the British government had treated some Iranian citizens in Dubai and telling me that they were not going to give me a visa in Dublin and that I had to go to Dubai to meet him face to face if I had any chance of a visa. And I just said, look, I can't just get from Dublin to Dubai, although there are direct flights, Dublin Airport, use it well. I can't just get there like I'm getting on a bus, so I'm not going to come. And then he backed down. I went to Tehran. That was absolutely fascinating. I'm very lucky. I've been to over 100 countries. I think I've been to 115 countries, and I'm a geek enough to count them. And the vast majority of them are about football. The atmosphere in Argentina is better than anywhere in the world. As an Englishman, when they sing, if you don't dance, you're an Englishman, every single week, as they still do in Argentina, my backstory, because I can speak Spanish, is that I'm actually from Dublin. I've never needed it. So, you know, the piece I've done today was about going to the Arctic Circle. I love meeting people. I like meeting interesting people. And I once met a guy in Dublin ahead of that Tehran trip. He was trying to get into football and it was in Dublin to learn English, Diego Flores. And years later, he became the assistant manager of Leeds United under Marcelo Bielsa.
Wow.
And that was a story I will write. Now, I'm not going to write it now because he's only just left Leeds. And Diego was working in Temple Bar trying to learn English. And there will be Dubliners who know Diego. And I'll write that story when it's ready to be written. And I've played a long game. And I'd like to think that he'll come to me first when he's ready to write that story.
Yeah.
And I met him, 6 years ago now? And when I saw him in Perth, Australia, as the manager of Leeds United, because he could speak English and Marcelo didn't last year, I was absolutely flabbergasted that a guy who was working in a shop in Dublin selling South American tea to tourists was now the figurehead of Leeds United, having played Manchester United in front of 55,000 people. But what a wonderful sport and what a wonderful world.
Thank you very much to Andy, and thanks to you as ever for listening and for supporting the show and the 42 as a whole. You make it possible for us to do this podcast and pretty much for possible to do our jobs. So you're great. Thanks very much. We're going to be back next week with another great guest here on Behind the Lines. But until then, take it easy.